This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. At what point are you too drunk to drive? In some states, that can turn out to be a trick question. Not because the standard is fuzzy, but because the testing equipment gives results that may not be reliable. Machines to test blood alcohol content have been around for decades, including some small enough to fit on the ignition of your car. But a new investigation from the New York Times shows the testing equipment used by many law enforcement agencies is far from accurate. People have ended up behind bars over dubious results, and possibly others who were truly drunk have gone free. How did this happen? And how can we make the system fair? Joining us from NPR in New York is Jessica Silver Greenberg. She's one of the reporters behind the New York Times investigation. Jessica, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us from Belchertown, Massachusetts is Joseph Bernard, a defense attorney for drunk driving cases statewide. Joe, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And with us from Canada in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan is Jan Semenoff, a forensic criminalist. A criminalist helps examine and analyze evidence in criminal cases. He's also the editor of Counterpoint Journal, a publication about the intersection between science and the law. Jan, glad to have you with us.
Hello, and thanks for the opportunity to speak.
Also be glad to have your questions and thoughts about breathalyzers, especially if one has ever factored in a DUI or impaired driving case for you. We'd also love to hear from you if you are in law enforcement. Share what you know about the machinery that you use or have used to measure blood alcohol content. Email us 1A at WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. I should note at the outset, we did reach out to a number of the big manufacturers of these companies, including Intoximeters, Dräger, and CMI. They either did not respond or they said they were not able to provide someone for our conversation, but that invitation stands. Jan, let me start with you. Can you just give us the basics? How does a breathalyzer work?
There's no such thing as a basic answer to that one. There's a couple of different technologies that are used. The handheld units that are used at roadside incorporate a thing called a fuel cell. So basically, when a person provides their breath sample into the fuel cell device, any alcohol that is contained in that breath sample generates a small amperage, small current, that is in turn read by the device as a blood alcohol concentration. Those units are relatively inexpensive, fast and easy to operate, and they're used across Canada and the United States on a daily basis by police agencies. Based on the results of that specific test, then a person will be brought down to the police station where they blow into a more complex and scientifically based evidentiary level instrument that can use a combination of different technologies.
What does the manufacturing landscape look like in terms of the companies that make breathalyzers? I mean, they've been used in law enforcement for decades and decades, right?
Well, they've been used basically since about the 1950s. The original breathalyzer that everybody refers to was actually a patented device that was created by a specific corporation. They called it the breathalyzer, and it's become so ubiquitous that now everything is generically referred to as a breathalyzer. In North America, there are basically four different companies, each produce their own versions of a breathalyzer. There's Dräger, there's Datamaster, there's Intoxilizer, and Intoximeter. And it's helpful maybe to think of these like, you know, a Ford, a Chev, or whatever, a GM. These different manufacturers each use their own software and their own hardware designs to create that evidentiary level device.
And Jan, just to be clear, I've heard the term breathalyzer, intoxilizer. That'll come up in a bit. What's the difference?
Again, that's a brand name. So it's like saying I drive a Ford or I drive a Chev. An intoxilizer is manufactured by CMI Incorporated, and Alka-Test is manufactured by Dräger. So they're just different manufacturers for the same sorts of devices.
Jessica, walk us through some of the key findings of your investigation. Were there one or two big takeaways?
There were. So I think I always like to focus on the things that, as reporters, surprised us in our investigation, because I think they tend to be good kind of points to focus on in now. So I think Stacey and I went into this investigation largely like most people do, which is okay, these tests are being used in police departments across the country, and they're marketed as accurate to the third decimal place. So, you know, if you go to any of the manufacturers and you look at any of their marketing materials, they say, oh, no, 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 these things are basically infallible. We're supposed to trust these machines as if they kind of are all-knowing.
Infallible, they say.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, they may not use the word infallible, but they say, you know, our technology is accurate to like 0.000003, you know, it's accurate all the way out. So what we found, though, is that that is just false. So the machines are actually often unreliable, and they generate skewed results, whether too high or too low, with alarming frequency. And the reason I say alarming is because these tests, because they are the centerpiece of so many criminal cases, have an enormous power. You know, they are used to convince juries to convict, and often they are the single piece of evidence that the state has in bringing a drunk driving prosecution. So we found that, you know, tens of thousands of these cases of these tests are actually questionable. And what the thing that shocked me most, I think, what surprised me most, is that when problems are found with these instruments, the solution has been to throw out years of tests. And what that does, what that means, is that people who were probably most likely drunk, so were found to, you know, with breath test results that were so high that the level of alcohol in that person's blood as measured by the machine is enough to like put someone into a coma, or they should be dead driving at that level of intoxication, that some of those drivers are now back on the road because states have had to, as a fix to problems with these machines, just throw out those people's tests. And so when the breath test goes away, the conviction often follows.
We heard from some of you who have had experiences, including as law enforcement officers, dealing with these breath testing machines. Here is what Wayne left in our inbox.
My name is Wayne. I'm a law enforcement officer in the Wilmington, North Carolina area. I had over 150 DWI DUI convictions, and never once did I have an issue with the intoxilizer instrument. It's no longer called a breathalyzer. Never once had to use field sobriety test in conducting an arrest for DWI DUI, and had 100% conviction rate for the DWI DUI incidents. Those intoxilizer instruments are finely tuned. They worked every single time I used them, and they worked very well. So they were very well in those interdictions.
Wayne, thank you for sharing your story with us. Jessica, in terms of the machinery being finely tuned, what does that mean? What does it take to tune one of these machines?
So I think Wayne's point is a good one, right? He's saying that the machines that he used to secure those convictions were finely tuned. But that's kind of a critical point. So in order to work correctly, the machines have to be properly calibrated and they have to be properly maintained. These are basically like chemistry sets that are at police departments. So if any aspect falls away, so if there's a problem in that chain, so if they're miscalibrated, if they're poorly maintained, as in Massachusetts, we found that Massachusetts was using a machine that had a family of rats that had nested into it. Or if the
machines... back up. Rats?
Yeah.
In the machine. How is that possible?
They were
I'll
so...
This
machine was so poorly maintained. Joe could speak to this since he's in Massachusetts.
Yeah, Joe, would you jump in here? How do rats nest inside a breathalyzer machine?
As lead counsel in this, what I'm hearing is right on target. But I also heard law enforcement, isn't that the problem? The attitude of infallibility and the pushback that we received in Massachusetts. This is the issue, and Jessica was hinting at it, that there are so many different algorithms in the computing of a breath test. What happened in Massachusetts was we discovered that the maintenance and calibration of these machines were being done without protocol. Now, any scientist will tell you, and Jan will tell you, how important it is when you calibrate any measurement device, any scientific device, that there's a particular protocol, a recipe to do that. And what was going on in Massachusetts, unbeknownst to law enforcement, unbeknownst to the prosecutors, unbeknownst to the judges, that these machines were being calibrated in one way by technician number one and a different way by calibration by technician number two. We didn't know that. And the pushback that we received from Draeger and the Office of Alcohol Testing was to such a degree that we weren't supplied over 400 failed calibrations nobody knew about until we exposed it in the discovery request. And as Jessica was pointing out, unfortunately, what happened was, once we discovered that, this was the enormous discovery violation that put potentially 27,000, and those letters are going out in 2 to 3 weeks, 27,000 breath test cases at risk because of the delicate balance that goes into calibrating these machines. Defense lawyers, judges, and as I say, nobody knew that over 400 times these machines, we used the Draeger exclusively in Massachusetts, had failed.
I want to continue talking about the way that we, I want to talk about the way that we continue to get these results more accurate and what seems to go wrong in the system as we continue our conversation. We'll get to some of your stories as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing a recent New York Times investigation that casts doubt on the reliability of breathalyzer tests. We're speaking with Jessica Silver Greenberg, a business reporter for The Times who worked on that investigation, defense attorney Joseph Bernard, and Jan Semenoff, a forensic criminalist and the editor of Counterpoint Journal. We'd love to hear from you if you are or were a law enforcement officer. We'd love to know your experiences working with breathalyzers. Maybe a faulty test affected you or a loved one. We'd love to know what happened, or perhaps you just have questions about this whole system of using breathalyzers and dealing with DUIs and the investigations, etc. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. Let me get to some of your stories, and you have sent us quite a few about various aspects of breathalyzers. Suzanne emailed, "I'm a mother of two teenagers and got an alcohol-related OVI, that's operating a vehicle impaired, an alcohol-related OVI a year ago. In order to see my children, I must use a breathalyzer sold by a private company that sends emails to my children's father documenting my sobriety. This device cannot be used within 20 minutes of eating or drinking anything, and by the company's admission, can produce a false positive. This has happened to me on a number of occasions, often after drinking soda or eating fruit." Jan, what about that? How is it that officers can know with a reasonable degree of certainty that these breathalyzer tests are not only accurate, but they're not affected by things that could produce false positives?
Well, I want to talk about not only that, but also Wayne's comment. I mean, he is a police officer who is using these things. And I think you've introduced me as a forensic criminalist and an editor, and I'm both of those things, but I'm also a retired cop. And in my policing days, I did more than 800 breath tests as a breathalyzer or intoxilizer operator. I relied heavily on those devices. And the short answer to your question, Joshua, is that you can't tell if they are properly calibrated. The unit will give you a couple of air blanks and it'll do a calibration check. But we don't know if the air blanks are actually truly zero, because they are what's called a floating air blank.
I'm sorry, Jan, you'll have to define that term. What is an air blank?
Okay, an air blank, the first thing that happens with a breath machine is that it wants to test the room air that the evidentiary test is being done in. This doesn't happen at roadside with the handheld devices. This only occurs back in the station with the big units, if you will. And what it does is it sucks in a sample of the room air to do two things. Number one, say, hey, there's nothing in this room that's going to give a false positive result. And secondly, I'm truly at zero at this particular point. I'm good to go. I'm cleaned out and I'm ready to take an appropriate breath test sample. The problem with the design of these units is that that's a floating zero. You can have a particular amount and they will just simply subtract it and say, hey, anything less than that, we're going to call it a zero. And that became a real issue in places like Colorado. So the officer takes a look at his readings, takes a look at the zero and the calibration checks and says, hey, everything is working perfectly, when in fact, behind the scenes, they don't know that the calibration could be out and the air blanks aren't reporting accurately.
Kirk emailed, my attorney discovered the officer in my case had completed a form for calibration testing that can only be performed after the suspect has taken the test. I had declined the test. This discovery only deepened my feelings that from the moment I was pulled over, I was being railroaded and couldn't trust the test that would be used against me. Technology aside, the whole process is suspect. Scott wrote on our Facebook page, in most states, you're legally allowed to refuse a breathalyzer test in lieu of a blood test at the station, mainly because the latter is way more accurate. Joseph Bernard, could you respond to Scott's comment?
Sure. So, Scott, to start from the back and move forward, he's right. The gold standard now clearly is a direct test of the blood. What we have with a machine is we have an indirect test of the blood. Most states punish people for a blood alcohol level, yet we use a breath testing machine to do that. So it's an indirect way to bring a result of the blood alcohol. The way to test a blood alcohol is to test the blood. So he's absolutely right. The gold standard is a gas chromatograph. That's how you test blood alcohol. It is not with a breath test. And scientists will tell you that it is a dinosaur of a machine for the quantification of a result. If you want to have a screen, is it yes or no, is there alcohol in the bloodstream? That's fine. But to quantify it with this type of machine, it's just not reliable enough. And there's too much that can go wrong with all the different parts that are moving in the machine. So he's right. I also say this. In many states, they use the term calibration when it really is not a calibration. And Jan can talk about this. It's a verification. They don't calibrate the machine at a police station. They calibrate it when they bring it back to the laboratory and perform very, very specific changes and fixes of the machine, if you will. That does not happen at the police station, and it only happens with a trained, certified lab technician.
Yeah, Jessica, could you respond to Kirk's email in terms of that form for calibration? We got a number of comments from listeners who felt like it's not exactly human error, but the human element also factors in terms of whether or not people are cutting corners or they have a vested interest in making it look like they arrest more people than they actually did. Jessica, did you find that in your work?
Absolutely. I mean, we found that many of the problems with these machines stem directly from human error, both human error and kind of lax oversight. So to return to answer both questions, if you look at something what Wayne said, right, he is an officer and what he said about, you know, doing hundreds of these tests and having them all be accurate, that he very well believes that that's true. And from his perspective, it is true. But what he doesn't know and what he may not have known is that there can be problems that police officers roadside have no idea about. And that's what we found in our investigation again and again. So once someone at the lab level, at the police lab level, started to take a look at these machines and really scrutinize them, it was like a kind of Pandora's box. So, for example, one of the things that we looked into was what happened in Washington, D.C. So you have in Washington, D.C. in 2010, you have this veteran police officer who comes into Washington, D.C., and his first kind of order of business, the first thing he's going to do is he wants to just test the intoxilizer machines just to see how they're working and if they're working correctly. And he found that His predecessor, the person who had oversaw the breath testing program for 14 years, so more than a decade, right? Well, more than a decade, had routinely entered incorrect data to calibrate the machines, which means they had been miscalibrated and they were spitting out results that were at points 40% too high. And that's not something that your average cop on the roadside or back at the station would have any idea about. So I think one of the things that I think was most revelatory about our investigation is that two things can be true. Police officers can believe that at the roadside they are doing everything accurately, in everything in their power to ensure an accurate test. But that may not matter because they may be using machines that have been programmed and rolled out incorrectly from the start.
Jessica, miscalibrating a breathalyzer machine, is that legal?
Well, it's legal if you do it by error. I mean, if you're purposefully miscalibrating it, that's a whole other story. We didn't find evidence of purposeful miscalibration to, you know, get more convictions. What we did find was just human sloppiness. We found that there's a wide variety of expertise in the state crime labs in terms of how to actually do this. So in Colorado, we found, for example, that that the lab there was rushing to meet a deadline to roll out their machines. And in order to get everything out and into police stations on time, they resorted to a kind of clownish, haphazard process where they called in people with absolutely no scientific expertise. They had an intern at one point setting up their machines. And the intern later testified like he'd helped his dad, you know, in the garage fixing various things, but he'd never dealt with a machine that had the power to put someone in jail and deprive them of their civil liberties. So, you know, it's just been a kind of a mess, and it's not anyone setting out to purposely miscalibrate these machines or to set them up poorly, but that has been the result.
Joe, are there punishments for police officers if it's discovered, or law enforcement agencies, if it is discovered that they did not properly calibrate their machines either through intention or through negligence?
Well, there is, but not specifically. For example, in Massachusetts, when we discovered this, the governor stepped in and shut down the Office of Alcohol Testing, and he dismissed the actual director of the laboratory because, as Jessica was saying, what's going on here, I don't think is anything somebody's consciously making effort to deceive, but what's going on is just gross sloppiness and negligence. And without complete transparency, what happens is people, you know, for example, in Massachusetts, what was going on is when these machines would fail to calibrate, they would literally put them up on a shelf, go and try to calibrate another machine, and then they'd go back to the other machine a day or two later and hope it works. And nobody knew that there was problems with the machine. So that machine might go back out on the street, test somebody's breath when there was all kinds of inner working problems with it. So although there are no specific crimes that are being committed because it's just negligence, what happens is the executive office, the governor of Massachusetts, went in and conducted a very thorough investigation and reorganized the entire lab in Massachusetts and actually, as I said, terminated the director.
Matt tweeted, "The caller Wayne is wrong. As a 28-year member of the regional hazmat team, I am intimately familiar with the test equipment and its limitations. They are rarely calibrated correctly and quite often give false positives or negatives. We use at least two different technologies to test hazmat materials." Kristen writes, "I had one breath test work in my favor. I knew I was drunk, and for some reason, I kept blowing zero. They said it was environmental interference, but since I repeatedly blew zero, they had no probable cause and had to let me go." I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's get to another voicemail from a listener. Here's what John from Tucson left in our inbox.
"I was pulled over many years ago and went through that walk test and everything, passed them, but was still arrested and handcuffed, taken into the station and given a test on an intoxilizer, which is a breath test. I passed, and they kept me at the station for over an hour, telling me to breathe harder because I was close but not inebriated. When I finally passed their test showing that I was inebriated, they aborted all of the previous tests. I ended up fighting it in court with a jury and eventually lost after about 6 months.
John, thank you for sharing your story with us. Jessica, some of your reporting also includes people who were kind of an edge case, sort of like John, but they were still charged with something, maybe not charged with what they would have gotten if they had blown 0.08 or above the legal limit. But from the way your report is written, it almost sounds like some law enforcement agencies were searching for something to charge this person with rather than just saying, oh, OK, you're not over the limit. We'll let you go.
There's one woman I interviewed who I thought had a particularly kind of poignant case that speaks to the caller's experience and is very similar, but with pretty devastating personal effects. The woman's name is Cindy Tyler, and she lives in Washington State. And she was pulled over on a November night, actually almost a year ago today, and the road she was driving on was pretty icy, and Cindy was she was hugging the center line. She was trying to avoid the ice and snow that had packed up alongside the road. And the officer in his report said that he pulled her over because she was veering into oncoming traffic. And we know, based on looking at the dashboard camera, that that's actually not true at all. But he pulls her over, and he asks her to blow into a roadside breathalyzer machine. So the one with a fuel cell, the one that Jan has mentioned in the past. And she, on that machine, blows a 0.09, which is above the legal limit. So they take her back to the station, and she at this point is hysterically crying because, you know, she's terrified, and she does not believe she's drunk or too inebriated to drive. And so they bring her back to the station, and on the station's machine, she blows a 0.06, which is well below the legal limit of 0.08. But the officer still charges her there with a DUI. So she goes, and so that's an example of the breath test was not high enough to automatically trigger that drunk driving charge.
So the officer knew that the test was not high enough, but charged her with DUI anyway?
Yes, exactly. And that does happen because the officers have the liberty to incorporate their own observations and make a charge, even if the breath test is not high enough to warrant that charge. And then it kind of then the idea is if the person decides to fight it and take it to trial, the jury will decide based on the evidence, which is the breath test and also the officer's observations. In Cindy's case, she wanted to fight it. Her brother had been killed as a college student by a drunk driver. And so she was adamant that she would never get in the car if she was impaired. And it was a point of pride for her that she would not plead to something that she didn't do. So she decides to fight it. Unfortunately for Cindy, Cindy is a commercial driver. So just the existence of that drunk driving charge on her record cost her several jobs. And it meant that she couldn't do the thing that she loved, which was driving. She drove for old age homes. She drove school buses. She drove dump trucks at one point. She just loved being on the road. And it took a year for the case to go to trial. And when she went to trial, she was acquitted. But the damage had already been done. She had already lost a job. She'd had to move without any income into her motorhome.
Mm-hmm.
And she is now on public assistance. So the consequences of these tests can be huge.
I want to talk about what we do in the future to make these tests more accurate and to ensure that people are getting justice when they are accused of DUI as we continue with Jessica Silver Greenberg, Jan Siminoff, and Joseph Bernard. Stay with us. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Jessica Silver Greenberg of the New York Times, defense attorney Joseph Bernard, and forensic criminalist Jan Siminoff. Jan, I'd love your response to an email from Ron. Ron writes, I'm an analytical chemist and a product manager for a manufacturer of laboratory reference materials. Daily, I will get a customer who doubts the validity of one of our products because they aren't getting the same value for one of my calibration standards. I have to walk through their procedure with them, and usually I will find some glaring problem. If this happens so often with professionals in the field, I shudder to think how often it happens with cops. Without a professional chemist, how are innocent people supposed to defend themselves? Jan?
Well, a couple points there. That's a huge problem. But we need to talk about what Joe had mentioned a couple of minutes ago. There's a big difference between a calibration, which actually corrects the value of a breath testing device back to the factory setting that it should have, and a calibration check that's done at the police station with an individual breath test. They're very different things. One is just a check, so the unit is never actually calibrated when the test subject is blowing into it. It's only ever calibrated on an annual basis. And you know what? I've calibrated these devices. I used to be responsible for doing that in my own police department. And they are difficult to calibrate, and they drift over time. It's very difficult to do these calibrations and get them exact. It's very difficult for scientists to do certain calibrations and get things exacting. To have a police officer or a technician at the crime lab do it can certainly be problematic.
And Jan, I just want to make sure I understand what you're getting at. It sounds like what you're talking about versus in this calibration check versus a calibration is the difference between like using a digital scale and you push that button where it re-zeroes and opening the scale to replace the springs.
Right. I mean, think about the calibration check as just a verification that things are within the acceptable tolerance, the acceptable range that they need to be. On an annual basis, the unit is supposed to go back to the crime lab or back to the manufacturer. And at that particular point, it's cleaned, adjusted, and calibrated again so that it is returned to factory standards. What we're finding, though, in many jurisdictions is that that's an expensive process. And so they're simply running the machines down until they malfunction, and they fix them once they're broken. They're not doing the preventative maintenance on them and the preventative calibration on them. And this is the equivalent for you never doing an oil change on your car and driving the thing until it just breaks.
Jessica, your reporting showed that some manufacturers, and we should note we did invite three manufacturers, Intoximeters, Dräger, and CMI, to be part of our conversation. We either did not hear back or they said they were not able to provide someone. So, Jessica, according to your report, some manufacturers also played a role in these machines being faulty from the outset. In some cases, models were deemed unsatisfactory by the labs, but they got sold anyway. How does that work?
We found that it happened on numerous occasions where I think you have to start with the idea that there is no real national standard here. So each state decides what its standards are going to be and how those standards are going to be met. So in some instances, Washington State comes to mind. One of Washington State's own scientists evaluated a number of machines and said, you know what, I don't think the Dräger machine is ready for market. And then he puts in that recommendation. And fast forward a couple of years, and the state, his own lab, is seemingly overruling his objection and choosing the machine that he deemed not fit. So some of this is just an oversight problem in that there are not – we've found that there weren't really strict standards of oversight for how these things are decided. And then Another thing you have is you have inconsistencies across states. So, for example, we found that Vermont tested one of these machines and said, oh, this is, you know, they raised red flags. They said, this should not be used. This is not good enough to be used in the field. But at the same time that they made that decision, other states were using that very same machine and went on to use it on tens of thousands of other tests. So it's a question of, or it's a problem of no standard, no national standards that are being implemented.
Has there ever been an effort to make a national standard?
Not that I am aware of, no. And the manufacturers, you asked about the manufacturers, and they do play a very real role here. And in our investigation, we found that their role was they fight like hell to make sure that no independent experts can actually get inside those machines and see how they work or if they are working correctly. We interviewed two hackers and security experts, one of whom had worked on top secret stuff at Microsoft, and he found that the security requirements that Draeger, the company whose machines he was looking into, the security requirements that Draeger was imposing were far more stringent than even what he had been subjected to at Microsoft. So you have a problem here where the manufacturers are saying there's nothing to see here. Our machines are completely accurate, and don't take a look under their hoods.
That's
an issue.
Joe, that might get to how we try to ensure better results. Let me get to another voicemail we got from another law enforcement officer sharing their experience with breathalyzers. Here's what Jacob had to say.
My name is Jacob from Alabama. I've worked in and around law enforcement for over 10 years. And I'd just like to comment on the story about breathalyzers. One thing that you have to bear in mind is that the breathalyzers used in the field are improving, and that's noteworthy. Secondly, anyone who is arrested roadside for DUI is going to be subjected to a secondary test inside of a jail facility called a Draeger, and where they would be able to have a more accurate test done. So outside of FSTs or field sobriety tests, the roadside machinery that's used, there would be that secondary layer of protection, so to speak, to test the subject's blood alcohol level inside of a secure facility.
Jacob, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Joe, your reactions to this idea that there are multiple layers that might help mitigate the possibility of a purely inaccurate test?
The problem with that is every single state now has what is called a per se conviction, which means that the preliminary breath test, the portable breath test that happens on the side of the road, doesn't get admitted. What occurs is when the citizen is brought back to the police station and subjects themselves to this machine, it's the machine itself, it's the result itself that produces a guilty or a not guilty. The jury instruction that the jurors will hear is this: if you find that the citizen's breath test was over a 0.08 and you believe that to be valid, you must, not can, not you can take it into consideration, you must find that the defendant guilty. It's a bright line. The machine is making the decision, and the jury doesn't have any. So if you don't have any of that background information that we've been talking about, the jury is left with this idea that they must, according to the judge, convict that person.
Joe, I'm sorry to interrupt, Joe, but the jury instruction kind of confuses me. You said that if the jury sees a result of 0.08 or higher and they mm-hmm. believe that to be valid, that they must yep. convict, but without any additional information.
That's correct.
It sounds like what they're basically saying is, if you see a blood alcohol level of 0.08 or higher and you understand numbers, you have to convict this person. Like, what else would they have to go on?
You don't have any choice, right? There's no wiggle room. And that's the problem. When you get all this pushback from the labs and from Drager, you've got judges and prosecutors who buy into this. They don't have any of the background information that we spent years on in Massachusetts and Washington, and they're left with the 0.08. The jury hears that, and then they're given that instruction. That instruction is pretty consistent from California all the way to Massachusetts. It's called per se. It's a bright line. If it's 0.08 or above, convict. So it's the machine, right? And I think that was the actual title, guilt by machine. That's the problem.
Matthew, Jessica, go
sorry.
Ahead.
There's one other point that the caller made that I think is a big misconception. So we've known for many, many years that the tests given on the roadside are finicky. They're inaccurate. They can be swayed by all different kinds of things. They can be swayed by burping, by breath mints, by hand sanitizers. All different kinds of things can sway those results. And the belief for a long time, and what we were looking at when we went into this investigation, was that even though those roadside tests may be unreliable, the ones back at the station are the ones that are going to give you the accurate result. And what we found in our investigation is that those machines, the ones that are supposed to be ultimately reliable, that go into the conviction, that go into what Joe's talking about, those are unreliable as well.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Matthew emailed, I am an officer, and at least in my district, we don't rely solely on the breathalyzer on scene. My training experience says that the breathalyzer number is not evidentiary in court on scene. Officers with my organization rely on field sobriety test, observations of driving behavior, and many other factors. I would say that DWI cases are complicated, and the breathalyzer machine just confirms what we already know, which is the presence of alcohol. They are not the foundation of good DWI cases. Jan, I wonder where you see kind of the future of this sort of metric going. Earlier this year, there were researchers at the University of Pittsburgh that detected a kind of a cannabis breathalyzer that can detect THC, which is the psychoactive chemical in cannabis, in a driver's breath. How, if at all, do you think that these revelations about alcohol breathalyzers will affect the way we use this array of machines in the future?
Well, you raise an interesting point because what we're learning now about breathalyzers, or some of us have known for a number of years, are certainly going to be present in the new drug detection devices. I just had an opportunity, as an aside, to do a whole series of experiments using dose subjects here in Canada who had just consumed cannabis products. And we found that we were getting false positives and false negatives on the Drager drug testing device as well. We got false positives for people who had eaten a poppy seed muffin or had drank a particular type of herbal tea. CBD oil was also creating a false positive with these devices. So even when we're using something that is the newest, brightest bulb in the array, they still have an opportunity to have confounding technologies.
So, Jan, what should we do as we're winding down our conversation? It sounds like currently law enforcement in many places, in many states, cross your fingers, they might or might not know exactly how to tell what's in your body. You could end up with a law enforcement agency that just feels like cooking the books or fudging the numbers or was too lazy about calibrating the machine or the officer's tired and just didn't feel like testing you again. Jan, what the hell are we supposed to do? Like, where do we go with this?
Well, a couple points, Joshua. First of all, I've got video evidence in cases I've been involved with where even when the test blows zero or under 0.08, the officer invalidates the result and charges a person with refusing a breath test, which in many jurisdictions carries the same penalty. Number one, don't drink and drive. That's
well,
the takeaway
sure,
here.
Yes.
You know, cabs are cheaper than Joe Bernard and myself, and it is imperative that we keep the roads safe. I would suspect that if you've had more than one or two drinks, you should not get behind the wheel of a car. I don't trust the breath machines, and I don't trust the roadside testing devices. Once you kind of get on that treadmill, the officers sometimes get investigative mindset, and they're going to find what they're looking for. So be really cautious is my first thought. My second thought is it's only through the sanitized disinfectant of the sunshine in an article like the New York Times, where this raises public awareness, do we actually start talking about this and learn that this bedrock of the criminal justice system is not as reliable as everybody has been saying?
Joe, what about you as we're winding down? What would you like to see happen from here?
I think a very simple fix is this. I don't think we should be able to use breath testing devices as quantification for results to convict people. I think it can be a screening device to alert and be assisting law enforcement to determine whether there is alcohol in somebody's body. But the quantification is the problem. And that is what I think needs to change immediately.
And Jessica, where is this going? Is there any larger effort to try to improve these results, set a national standard to do something about this, either from the manufacturers or from governments?
I think some governments have done what Joe was describing, which is when they've spotted problems, they have realized that the labs they've relied on have been ill-equipped to properly maintain or calibrate these machines. And they've taken responsibility from those labs to and shifted them so that they've upped the level of expertise and the level of kind of awareness of what can go wrong with these machines. But I think another thing, and this is not on the state level, but you're seeing this kind of in individual jurisdictions, is and some judges have said that the answer is transparency. So, you know, they've said, let defense experts go in and get a real close look at these machines and kind of crowdsource it, right? So these machines can be built better, they can be designed better, and they can be maintained better. And if you let more people look at them and really get under the hood, then you can spot problems before they end up resulting in wrongful convictions.
Jessica Silver Greenberg of the New York Times. Jessica, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Defense Attorney Joseph Bernard. Joe, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Jan Semenoff, forensic criminalist and the editor of Counterpoint Journal. Thank you, Jan.
Thanks, Joshua.
This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you very much for listening. This is 1A.